we ended up with a project that's had one major historic mine. It's had a huge amount of drilling. It's got multiple resources at a very cheap price because we were able to sort of unscramble the egg with the history of that project.
Okay, so I'm going to give you my 2 cents and our listeners my 2 cents here. And just please, I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, if I didn't hear you correctly. You basically got a great asset that's already been explored and already drilled, already permitted, and nothing could have been done with it. And you picked it up pretty much out of bankruptcy. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And it wasn't a full-on bankruptcy.
Mark,
that's
a great story. Let's
call it mothballed. And so the transaction in the end was we paid $15,000 in cash, $100,000.
You paid how much
shares,
for it?
15,000 Canadian in cash.
So great.
And
for
and,
you.
And let's call some sweat equity as well, because it wasn't
sure.
easy. Kudos to the team in Vancouver.
Mark Saxon, T2 Metals, how are you?
Andy, good morning, good afternoon, depending on the jurisdiction. So lovely to meet you.
Yeah, well, I am in the southeast of the U.S., and so I didn't realize, I know you're based out of Vancouver, but you're originally from Australia. I didn't realize that we were going to be talking with you in Australia. So
yeah, well, it's a cold morning in Bendigo. So I was just saying minus 4 degrees this morning. So I'm sitting here with the heater on and ready for a good chat.
Awesome. So let's start with that. So you're originally from Australia, but you're working out of Vancouver, Canada. Why? What brought you to Vancouver as opposed to staying in Australia?
Yeah, sure. It's a long story, and I won't give you all the dirty details. But myself and my business partner, we were working for a major Australian company, which was called Pasminco, and we had been working in Australia in sort of separate divisions. And this was a company that had 5 or 6 mines and 5 or 6 zinc smelters around the world. Big company. And we got a transfer to South America. We had the company had done a major asset purchase, and we ended up living in South America in the early 2000s. So this is a guy named Michael Hudson, and we'll touch on that in a second. But that company unfortunately went into receivership, and so we were two guys at sort of the edge of the world and felt it at that time, and in a tough mining market. And we decided to sort of pull our forces and our resources and start to work together. And because we were living in South America, there was a lot more connection with Canadians than Australians in that jurisdiction. And all the companies working there, the juniors, were all TSX listed rather than ASX listed. So our network kind of developed to push us towards that Canadian market. And we were very fortunate to meet some people who opened their door to us. And we were two young guys in our early 30s and didn't know much about what we were doing, and have since managed to build a career around it. And so, thanks very much to Nick Demare, who's still our CFO in T2 Metals, and a guy named David Henstridge, who lives in Australia now as well, and got us moving. So Mike and I, we started with some project generation in South America. We came back to Australia and did some project generation. Then we headed to Scandinavia, of all places, and listed a company that is now called Mawson Gold. Doing extremely well with a great discovery in one in Finland and one in Australia. So, we've had a good career.
Excellent. So let me ask you then, why copper then with your background in gold? And that's to give you a little bit of background on that question. I am very interested, or how I started my career was specifically with gold and silver mining companies in the junior sector. But then recently, I've been that's what caught my attention, is that you guys are primarily copper. So tell me about that, why you're doing copper right now and your focus on copper.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's a great example that there's no straight lines in this business. Everything is kind of a little bit random motion. And where, I don't want to say that the junior companies sort of react too much to the market. There's no point bouncing around too much. But my career, in fact, has been quite a lot in other metals. So, I was involved in a very major discovery in Sweden. So I was the CEO of a company called Tasman Metals. And in fact, that's where the name T2 comes from. So Tasman went from from 20 cents to $6 about 10 years ago, based on a very major rare earth metals discovery in Scandinavia. And so that kind of, without a lot of forethought, that bumped my career from being sort of a typical, zinc, copper, gold geologist, bumped me towards rare earth metals, which is a really interesting sort of field, and I'm still engaged in that a little bit. But it kind of shows that as a geologist, your career goes all kinds of places and all different locations. When we sort of formed T2 Metals, and so T2 Metals has been formed by the same kind of team of people that I've always worked with, and some of those I named before. It was a shell company, and we were, and really we formed it during the COVID years. And for us in Australia, we were all sort of locked in and sitting at computers and couldn't travel. And so we were looking for good ideas and doing project generation. And it was when the real run up in the interest in battery metals, EV metals, was really coming through. And so I'd been working in graphite, and we'd owned a graphite mine in Sweden. We'd made this big rare earth discovery and done really well from that one. And a little bit of work in lithium, not too much, but had been involved in some good deals. But when you look at that sort of battery metals kind of shift, those other metals I've just mentioned, they're all interesting, but the really big one is copper. So copper, when you think about electrification, then copper is number one every single time, because everything that gets electrified is going to use copper. The performance of copper is perfect for electrification. There's no cheaper substitute that has the same kind of performance. It's incredibly embedded in everything around us. There's no ability to have sort of technology substitutions with copper, except around the margins of the business. And so, we were really passionate about that. And then I guess we started to see that sort of, let's call it the reshoring of production of metals. And so that was where I guess some investments were pulling away from more risky jurisdictions, pulling back towards Australia and Canada and the US and the Nordics and places where, that was the real COVID story, I guess, wasn't it? That we were sort of reshoring, friendshoring production. And so looking for a range of projects in friendly jurisdictions. And so we went for the US and Canada, really gave us that sort of voice in growth metals, EV metals and in good jurisdictions.
Well, that again was the same thing that stood out, is just the jurisdictions that you're in. And let's talk about this project specifically. You're in Arizona, which is a great mining state. You're in Nevada, which is probably the number one jurisdiction, or ranked the number one jurisdiction by many people in the entire world. And then you're in Canada, which is also a very friendly jurisdiction. Talk about those different projects that you have and what you got going on in those different jurisdictions.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess we've gone for, let's say traditional mining jurisdictions there that we know that if we find something, a mine can be built. And so, I've certainly worked in other locations where, great discoveries, but you can't sort of hand on the heart say that this project is going to progress in a sensible time frame. I'm sure you've seen the numbers, and 10 years to develop a mine is a good result these days. And so anything that you can do by putting yourself in a good jurisdiction, I think really helps that story. And you're able to sort of promote to investors and to customers to say, all right, we can sort of lay out a predictable timeline here because the permitting authorities understand what they're doing. And I think there's a lot of value in that. When you look, for example, at the copper shortages, then the copper shortages are pretty immediate. They're only 2 or 3 years away. We're not talking about sort of demand in 15 years' time. So there's a real opportunity to put yourself into a jurisdiction where you can move quickly. And there's been some great discoveries in copper and Chile, Argentina. There's a massive project in Pakistan. But these are going to take a long time to develop. They're big. Sort of generational projects. So the ability to be in a jurisdiction where you can move a little bit quicker, I think, was really attractive to us. And so, we chose Arizona, Nevada, and we're also working in Manitoba, and we can sort of tick through those. And so, Arizona has had, many, many major discoveries. It's got many major mines. Yeah, a couple have been held up a little in permitting, but that's how it goes. And there's no expectation in the mining industry that everything is going to sort of be seamless and predictable. We deal with natural environments and the unpredictability of nature. We obviously have a land use impact, and so we've got to acknowledge people who live on the land, who have lived on the land before us, and so we need to be mindful of that. But still, great jurisdiction. Nevada, as you said, is a great location and fairly low population in the mining regions. So we don't impact on many people. And then we jump north to Manitoba. And I must say, Manitoba was a place that before I started investing there with 2G Metals, I didn't know much about. And it was one of the places that sort of, is not often visited even by Canadians. To go there and understand, first of all, the geological potential, and second of all, the degree of support from the province, it really was quite amazing. And it's a place that we'll be dedicated to for a long time because of those opportunities.
Got it. Let's talk about, if you would, another thing that really attracted me to you was just analyzing your share structure. As a retail investor, if you would, that also does participate in private placements, but also buys in the open market. That is very important to me. A fear of being diluted, or even if I, when I buy in, that there's a bunch of warrants written above me. They're not going to be exercised, or, somebody selling against them, but they're a few years out. So if you could talk to me about the share structure, that would inform everybody. And that was very attractive to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, you sort of touch on, as an investor myself, my own thinking is that when you look at low market cap companies, you've got to be mindful that, it's hard to sort of work in that sort of, let's say sub $5 million, sub $10 million market cap range. And so when you're working at that low end, you're not really getting much value for your projects. But so really the key thing is to look at the share structure and look at the people involved, because a company can always get new projects, but those things you can't really change. And so you're sort of stuck with your share structure without a big rollback. So 2G Metals did a rollback in 2017, and so it was repositioned as a shell. And so that was, myself and some others put money in at those early stages just to sort of keep it going while we look for project. But I think it's fair to say I'm notoriously tight with money, and I know that the capital structure is very important to us. And so we before the financing, so we're just in the process now of closing the financing. We only had 29 million shares outstanding, and 34 million when including options and warrants. And so very tight company, and I guess even more to that, we understood where probably 50% of those shares were sitting, and they were sitting in strong hands, and people who had made money from our group before, people who'd made money from me in Tasman Metals before. And so they were people who bought and didn't sell. And so that's great. It's great to have those shareholders and sort of soak up that stock, but it does affect your liquidity. And so, we're now very focused on sort of improving that liquidity. So as I said, we're now sort of mid-financing and getting close to a close on that one. So that will push us up to about 40 million shares outstanding. Again, very tight, and that will see us with $3.5 million in the bank. So a very well positioned.
Okay, excellent. So you answered my next question, was the financing. So you just said you're gonna have about $3.5 million in the bank. So you'd have enough money theoretically to, again, who knows what happens, but you have something, anything negative that would happen, you'd help weather the storm. But also, what are you doing that would help get the word out about your company? Because one of the struggles that a lot of mining companies have is nobody knows about them and what separates you from somebody else. So is there a marketing plan, or is there a plan to take this to institutional investors to increase the share price? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, sure. And visibility is tough in the junior mining industry. There's lots of companies that sit in sort of that 10 million market cap kind of range. So to get your voice heard is not easy. And talking to people like yourself and really appreciate the support to help get the message out. And I guess I find it's quite easy to sell shares to people you know. It's hard to sell shares to people you don't know. And so it takes a long time to build up that momentum and that visibility. And so we do a little bit through social media, but as we move forward, we've got a much stronger plan. So yeah, you mentioned institutions in this financing. There's I think 4 institutional holders coming in. Some North American, some Australian, some European. The European holders are very active shareholders and very good at supporting their stories across that German market. So I think we'll see a bit of a focus on that market and telling our story a little bit more clearly there. We did a non-brokered financing in this case, just because we've got strong networks and we're able to do that. But we put a lot of shares through brokers and people who will give us some aftermarket support as well. And a lot more push and a lot more visibilities in terms of how we tell the story. And most of that's online these days. A few conferences, but most of it online.
Got it. So that's another thing is what really moves the stock is good news. And now I'm not asking you about specific good news right now, but I am asking, is there a timeline where people should be checking in with the website or social media where, let's say you're expecting news to hit in, I don't know, the month of July or the month of August or whatever have you?
Yeah, sure. And it's a good question. And news flow is key. And really, all small companies need to be mindful of generating news flow. And it's a hard thing to do when you don't have money, I suppose. So we've fixed the problem of not having money. So the next problem to work on is the news flow. So our major asset, and we can dig in a little bit deeper, is the project in Manitoba, a project called Sheridan. So the money that we've raised gives us the ability to do a pretty substantial drilling program there. So we're permitted for that. We've got First Nations support. It's a ground-based program, not helicopter, so it's relatively easy and nimble. So we'll be kicking off that program probably in August, we think. And so that gives us multiple months of drilling. So we're thinking probably three and a half months of drilling. So the drilling work, the discovery part of the drilling work, we can see things in drill core. We'll keep the market informed about what we see. And then the assays that come from that, kind of give us probably a 6 month, I guess, runway there of a very strong news flow. We're kicking off some work in the other projects as well and advancing those in the US. And so, we'll have overlapping news flow from multiple projects. And that will take us through into next year, which coming around probably.
Excellent. Well, let's nail down the project in Manitoba here. Why was that attractive to you? And tell us about the project and everything in there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one. I hope and fingers crossed it's going to make one of those sort of really rollicking exploration stories because it's got a lot of elements to it. And about how we identified the project and I guess it was one that had been forgotten. And it was when we looked at projects and looked for ideas, then we saw the Sheridan project, which is about 60 or 70 kilometers north of Flin Flon in Manitoba. Manitoba is a strong mining province. It's had a couple of very long-lived mines. So the Thompson Belt has been a world-class nickel producer. The Flin Flon Belt itself, or Flin Flon itself, with Hud Bay, has had 100 years of production. And then Snow Lake as well is a world-class mine. I guess we were attracted to that region for big deposits. And so we wanted to find something that made a difference. Yeah, a really strong deposit, really strong. And we saw in Sheridan that it was a project that 2010, it had 4 resources calculated, all near surface copper resources, sort of open pittable copper resources. It was done by a previous operator, so we now refer to them as historical resources, but they were done in a modern mining environment, 2010, so not that long ago. But the project kind of disappeared. The resources were quoted, and then, we really couldn't see sort of what happened to that. Usually you will see a resource quoted, and then you'll go PEA. And that didn't happen with these projects. So we kind of dug into that history, and we sort of thought, that's unusual. And it was kind of, what we call a corporate failure or a corporate problem that resulted in the projects not moving ahead. It wasn't a technical problem. So the resources were quoted at a time when the project was owned by a company called Halo Resources. And Halo did a very good job at exploring the project and through joint venture with Hudbay Mining. And so they, in fact, they did so well that Hudbay Mining exercised a clawback on the key parts of the project. And so, yeah, Hudbay had owned it. They kind of JV'd out to Halo, and then they sort of were taking the project back. But because metal prices were falling in 12 and 13, it was tough times in the market. Hudbay had challenges on some other projects, and so they didn't complete the clawback. And so the project then defaulted back to Halo. And so Halo by that time, yeah, had been taken over and delisted. It didn't have a team, didn't have money. And so there was no one really to pick up that project and that story again. And so it kind of was mothballed. But because so much money had been spent on the project and all of that money had been registered with the Manitoba Mines Department, the projects, the exploration licenses, the claims were still in good standing because, yeah, all that money had been spent. And so, in fact, the claims were in good standing until about 2028. So even if nothing else was spent. So they were sort of sitting there as, yeah, slightly in limbo. And so we identified that and found a way through, re-establishing the company, making sure that the company could do a deal again. And that's how we sort of got into the project. And so we ended up with a project that's had one major historic mine. It's had a huge amount of drilling. It's got multiple resources at a very cheap price because we were able to sort of unscramble the egg with the history of that project.
Okay, so I'm going to give you my 2 cents and our listeners my 2 cents here. And just please, I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, if I didn't hear you correctly. You basically got a great asset that's already been explored and already drilled, already permitted, and nothing could have been done with it. And you picked it up pretty much out of bankruptcy. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And it wasn't a full-on bankruptcy.
Mark, that's
a
great story. Let's
call it mothballed. And so the transaction in the end was we paid $15,000 in cash, $100,000.
You paid how much
shares.
For it?
15,000 Canadian in cash.
So great.
And let's call some sweat equity as well, because it wasn't easy. Kudos to the team in Vancouver
because it might not go anywhere. I get it.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't know how it was going to turn out. And so you say fully permitted. The claims were certainly all in place and fully granted.
That story used to be told.
Permits. Yeah. So when we took over the project, there was no drilling permits. And so I guess that was the first mission. We obviously had to spend a lot of time in speaking to First Nations communities, sort of understanding how to work at that location, making sure that we could sort of reestablish those contacts.
So we
were able to establish a very good exploration agreement with the First Nations and the Kisiwapa Cree who are now sort of good friends and very good partners on the project. We established that exploration agreement, which allowed us to then speak to the Manitoba government and get our drilling permits. And so we now have a very good runway in terms of what we need to do and land access in that region. So we've kind of been ticking the boxes progressively as we go through with this project.
Yeah. Okay. So my next question is let's assume everything goes according to plan. The new drilling goes according to plan. There's a lot there. What's the ETA on, the runway of getting a mine built?
That's always a hard question. So I won't use firm numbers, but I guess, if we sort of go through the things that make Sheridan attractive, and one of it's the ability to move quickly, is that we've got great infrastructure. So it's had a former mine on that location. So it produced about 8 million tons at 3% copper and 3% zinc. So that was sort of 1940s, 1950s. So a pretty substantial historic mine. And so that meant it's got It's got roads. In fact, it's got a railway that runs through the project that is still being used today by our First Nations community. It's got a small village. So it's got all of that sort of, first layer of supporting infrastructure. The small village has a good community that we can draw on and sort of withdraw staff when we can from that that community. It's in a forestry area, so there's forest roads, there's access. It means we don't use helicopters or winter drilling or ice roads or anything at the moment, so that's quick. We can be nimble. So that's obviously a big tick. We've got the near surface resources, which haven't done an economic study on them, but those ones are sort of sitting there. And then I guess the thing that really attracted us to this project is that it's got what we call a very big alteration footprint. So we know from across a broad area from 6 by 6 kilometers, all the rocks are altered, which means it's had that sort of hydrothermal fluid process at some time in its past where the rocks have all been changed. And so that's really exciting when you're sort of looking at these projects. So we know it's probably buried in there somewhere is a big ore body because we've got big alteration. I guess because we've got infrastructure, we've got people, we've got back in Flin Flon, it's got a copper smelter and a copper concentrator. Then again, gives us the ability to be nimble. The railway line that runs through our project hooks us back into Flin Flon. So we tick a lot of boxes there in terms of being able to move quickly. So good nations with First Nations communities, with the Kisiwapa Cree, who are very keen for us to be there. So that obviously is a big part of the world.
Yeah, it sounds like both the local and the provincial, I think I'm saying it correctly, provincial governments are very motivated to have you guys get to work as well.
Absolutely. And I guess the best sign of the support we've had from the Manitoba government is that we've been working there actively, as a really active company for, let's say, 12 months or perhaps a little bit more. And already we've been granted $520,000 Canadian dollars in grants to support our work. And so that comes through an agency called the Manitoba Mineral Development Fund. And so they're excellent in supporting our work. And so they sort of give a grant to companies that are active and have those First Nations agreement, doing the right thing, communicating well with government and with the community. So that's a pretty substantial grant in junior mining world. And as long as the money is spent in Manitoba, we match that funding and spend more of our own, obviously. But it's a very attractive position to be in.
Got it. Tell me real quick, because it sounds like the flagship project is in Manitoba. Just touch briefly on the project in Nevada and in Arizona, because those are also assets that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess what we've done is we looked at deposit styles and I don't want to sound too much like a geo, but we looked at deposit styles when we're doing our first exploration of the deposit styles that can produce big tons of copper. And so in Manitoba, we've got what's called a volcanic hosted massive sulfur deposit. So those styles of deposits can produce a lot of copper, as well as zinc and gold and silver as well. In Nevada and Arizona, those districts are better known for porphyry style copper mineralization. And so porphyries are the really big producers in terms of copper in the world. And so we focused our project generation on that. So the one that we particularly like is in Arizona. So that's called Cora. And so Cora is sort of halfway between Tucson and Phoenix, in that sort of high pedigree, best in the US copper belt, where there's most of the US copper production comes from sort of that district there. And what's called the Laramide district, Laramide orogeny, where lots of intrusions. So our project, we were looking for, and we generated this project before copper was hot, I suppose. So there was ground to be pegged that nobody else owned. So we kind of that first mover advantage and could be nimble. So we were looking and obviously I'm Australian and we come from strong exploration background in Australia. The thing that's been working in Australia is moving undercover. So where you don't see the rocks, where you don't see the outcrop, you move undercover and you look for sort of signals of what could be a mining district, but from more subtle signals than you can see at surface. So we were applying that same logic and at this Kora project, in the outcropping areas where the rocks are exposed, there's a small to medium-sized old mine that was called North Star. And North Star was a structurally controlled mine with high-grade copper, high-grade oxide copper that was mined in the 1950s. And we could see that in the old mapping and the old work that was done, and the structures from the outcrop areas from the mine were trending under an area that goes undercover. So when you stand undercover, you can't see anything. You're just seeing cactuses and soil. You can't see any rocks, and so you don't really know what's down there. But all the structure was trending that way, and so we were very excited about that. And the rocks at the outcrop areas were suggestive of a porphyry. So we staked the ground, and we had some evidence from past drilling. Good shout out to the guy that helped us, Chris Wainless, with project generation, and found some old historic data that had copper drilling results from the past from the 1950s. So there was a hole there that was 200 meters at 0.3 copper. And so really strong results under this covered area. And we were never quite sure exactly where that hole was, but we kind of staked all around it to make sure that we were covering it. And we then went and did some geophysics. So we did aeromagnetics and identified what we would call a thumbprint magnetic anomaly, which is kind of how porphyries look. And you imagine you've got an area of similar looking rocks and then, or sort of similar looking magnetic, and then within that you've got something that sort of looks kind of round, there's less magnetism and less magnetite. And that's because when a porphyry comes in, the alteration process of that tends to destroy the magnetics of the rock, and so you tend to get it as a magnetic low. And so undercover, had never been done before. We generated this mag low that looks very much like the porphyry, and then we were able to mix that with some CSAMT data, which is again another geophysical method, and that showed us that the depth of cover is not too deep, so it's kind of 50 to 100 meters, so we can drill through that cover, and test a really great target, and it's one that's really easy to test and on easy to work ground. It's lots of cactuses and pretty dry, but I guess that's all of Arizona, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, easy place to drill. Okay, cool. Yeah, excellent. I guess anything else you would want to add here as we're landing the plane?
If we just sort of go through the list of investable features that we see in TG Metals, and it works for many projects, but we've sort of put ourselves in a position where we can, making a major discovery, we'll see a big re-rating. And so I guess the features that I like about T2 Metals and I suppose I'm a big shareholder and let's acknowledge that I put personally in this financing. I did $150,000 into the financing. So a regular buyer in the market as well. So certainly I follow my own story there. We've got a really great, we've got a really great team of people. So, we've got some people who've worked with me and for me for a long time and real pleasure to work with. We've had successes in the past. So that makes my life easy. We're part of a very strong group, and I mentioned our back office in Vancouver. We've got a range of companies that have come out of there, and some of them very successful and made very major discoveries. Myself and Mike Hudson have been behind a lot of those ones and we continue to come up with good ideas. Very focused on copper and that demand for copper is exceptional at the moment. The shortfalls are now. They're not off in the future, they're now. And so copper prices achieving new highs. The concentrate conditions are as cheap as ever been. So essentially smelters are paying, or the comment is paying more for the flour than for the bread. That's what's happening in the copper market at the moment, because there's such a shortage in copper concentrates. We're working in really good jurisdictions. We've got a really tight capital structure. We've got enough money in the bank now from these financings to get real work done, to be able to commit to a proper runway of work and really add value to the company. And great project. We've generated some really good projects, and we'll continue to do so as a group. So I think that ticks most boxes that junior miners are trying to tick, and gives us a very good end.
Excellent. Mark, if you could give your company website address as well as your ticker symbols, that would be great. And I will also put these in the show notes.
Yep, super. We're nice and easy. So T2 Metals. So T2, the number, metals.com. So nice and easy. And TWO is our ticker on the TSX, where most of our stock trade.
Excellent. Mark, I want to thank you so much for your time. You've been very gracious, and it sounds like an amazing project. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. And enjoyed a lot and working with good people, and very happy to be part of this business.
Excellent. All right. Have a good day.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks for the time. Yeah. Cheers.